From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools Live. This is our first live show.
It's our first live show.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about Defrag if you haven't seen the show before. Defrag is a show that I do with Gov Maharaj.
Yep.
And we talk about, like, if you have a problem with your computer or your phone or your Xbox or whatever the case may be, and you need help with that, you send, hey, I got this problem, and we help work through the problem and help you become a better
Yeah, we do via email person. Mainly so that you we can interact with you and get log files and that type of stuff.
Yep, and then we do Defrag Tools,
and
that's where we talk about the tools that we use to figure out what went wrong and help troubleshoot other issues.
Yeah, it's a spin-off.
Yeah,
it's a true spin-off, and it's a way of us digging in deeper for when we can't afford, you know, half an hour on a tool when we can answer it in 5 minutes with the Q&A style with show.
And so today we're going to have a special guest with us. That's the empty chair here.
Yep.
And so, he'll be joining us here soon. That's going to be Mark Rusinovich. So, very special guest. Let's talk about his significance to the show.
Yeah, so Defrag Tools has gone through a lot of tools, and obviously a lot of the tools we use are the sysinternals tools. The sysinternals tools really are the main tools out there that are used by Microsoft support and just people generally out there. And we've dedicated, I think it was about 12 episodes around there to the sysinternals tool at the start of the series. We went through the big boys. We went through Process Explorer, Process Monitor. Process Monitor got a couple of episodes because we wanted to show what the tool was and then provide really good examples. And so we went through various scenarios to do with CPU usage and weird access denies and that type of junk and boot profiling, which is everybody loves to do to see how fast you can boot Windows.
I couldn't wait for that show.
Yeah.
I was up for days. And we should send a special shout out to Chad.
Yeah, Chad, the other cohort. Chad and I work together in the OEM support division, and we tag team the show. It takes a fair bit of effort to build up a show, and so we split the effort And so
tell us about what part of Microsoft you come from and what you and Chad typically do in
a
day.
Chad and I are busy at the moment. We are from a division called OEM Support. And so the OEMs, as you can well guess right now, are very busy trying to get stuff to market. We've gone through the tide of the WinRT release, and we're about to have the Windows Pro release of the product. So you'll start seeing beautiful tablets. I mean, At our desk at the moment, we have piles of tablets.
Oh.
And I cannot choose one at the moment. There is probably 10, 20 tablets in our division at the moment for various reasons, mainly minor reasons.
Yeah, Microsoft problems, having too many tablets to choose from.
Yeah, and some of them are just gorgeous. I mean, the touch on them, the color on some of these guys is just astounding. And when you have an x86, x64 tablet, what's called the Clover Trail tablets, you're back to that world that we're familiar with. And so you can run your favorite line of business application on it and all that type of stuff. And it's very familiar. And these things perform just so well. And it's been really, really good fun to get all these prior release stuff and just tweak the little problems.
Very nice. So, hey, I also want to mention, too, if you have any questions, if you want to talk about sysinternal tools or you want to ask some questions of Mark Rusinovich, go ahead and send them now. We'll get them staged up here. And if it's a tool problem or a tool question, we'll talk to Andrew here. And if it's for Mark, then we'll just wait on that one.
Yeah, definitely. So the good news about Windows 8 is it's very close to the feel of Windows 7 when you troubleshoot it. It isn't that much different, and which means that you can use that huge foundation of knowledge that you've built up over the last, when was NC3.1? So 20-something years, right? A lot of the fundamentals haven't changed, and a lot of the approaches haven't changed. You know, ask the PC to do too much, the CPU will be saturated. Leak memory, you'll have out-of-memory issues, and straight logic issues with crashes and stuff. So the good news is a vast, vast majority of the tools that you are used to using now, you use in the same way in Windows 8. Saying that, obviously Windows 8 has new features, so the tools, particularly the sysinternals tools, I know that Process Explorer, Process Monitor, Core Info is a command line tool that most people probably don't know about. It will tell you exactly how all the cores in your machine are physically connected and their latencies and stuff. And so there's all these brand new CPUs from AMD and Intel coming out with new feature sets, and that that program's been updated to understand those new
So if
designs.
You've been carrying around a bunch of sysinternal tools on a thumb drive,
you good.
It's time to update.
Well, you should try to...
Which ones are there new versions of?
So Process Explorer, Process Monitor, Core Info, and the one that I actually helped write for Mark, ProcDump. ProcDump is probably out of all the tools, had the biggest change. It, a couple of thousands of lines of new code to support debugging of the store applications, because a store application just is not the same as an application that we're familiar with from the years go by.
Interesting.
And but with sysinternals in general, subscribe on the front page. You go to sysinternals.com, and then there's an RSS feed there right on the front page. Just subscribe to that RSS feed, and only once per month. It's like Patch Tuesday for sysinternals, right? It comes out. When you see that, then download the zip file and reflush it. And we've actually, a couple of times on the show, actually have done that live, because we've known that a new feature came out that we want to show you. So we show you live on the show how to download the zip, unblock it, and then go use the feature.
Great. So we got a couple questions here. I want to get to these. Andy Wall says, are there any specific insights into WinRT apps in Process Explorer?
There is. So careful with the word WinRT. So we're talking about the Windows runtime here and rather than the flavor of Windows.
Yeah.
The main difference is security. If you go to a process, from memory, I don't think there's any new columns, but what you will see is you will see immersive as a new color type. So you can see this blue one. So under options, colors, there's a new immersive process. And immersive was the internal name for the store apps when it was being developed, and that hasn't been renamed. So you can see them. So there's that blue one there, and there's an Explorer XE itself is an immersive app. And if I started weather or something, you would see a WWA host or something else like that. But the other one you see, we'll just Explorer for the example, on the security tab, there's a whole lot of new authorities. So we've been kind of used to over the years having local system, which is NT authority/local system and stuff like that. In, I think it was either Vista or Windows 7, we added an authority for each Windows service. So it had its own user that represents the service. And it means you could do things like say, only this service is allowed to write to this folder on the hard drive. Well, that idea has significantly been moved forward in Windows 8. And you can see the one highlighted here, and you'll see it on the screen back here. But this says Microsoft account/then my email address. So we've added a whole lot of new groups that represent who you are. And so much more secure. And it comes down to the fact that these store applications are in a sandbox or in a much more controlled world. I mean, store apps can't talk to the hard drive. They can't talk to the registry like old apps used to, right? And so you're in this bubble of security. And the way that the security is navigated is through all these new things. So Mark had to do updates to understand that those new groups and display them appropriately. When it comes to the other tools, not as visual, not as obvious. It's more under the covers stuff. Just supporting the API. Network Process Monitor and Process Explorer both show you network traffic.
Yeah.
And so there's a system in Windows called Event Tracing for Windows, ETW. Mm-hmm. And that system is like an event data repository, which you can subscribe to. And there's thousands and thousands of these channels. And one of the channels was network traffic, right?
Yeah.
And the problem was that that channel and the way you read it was singular, so only one person could read from that data at once. And so you might have like Process Monitor up, and then another tool would say cannot start provider. So one of the big changes that was made in Windows 8 is a multi-provider model, and so multiple people can subscribe to it. So Process Explorer, Process Monitor, particularly who use ETW, they use the multi-channel now, so multiple people can read from the data at the same time. So that's good news from a unexpected support troubleshooting point of view. You try one thing, and normally you only try it in isolation, and then you go give it to the customer, and they go, it doesn't work. It's like, what? It always works. It's like, well, it was because you forgot that you did this other troubleshooting step, and it was still running in the background and stuff like that.
So we've got another question from Zippy V, and I believe that's a niner too, Zippy? It says, my new self-built PC with Windows 8 is pretty unstable, and it likes to crash a lot for different reasons. Could it be the third-party drivers are not yet stable?
Yeah, so what we're seeing a lot in the telemetry is there is a lot of drivers which aren't stable. One of the main changes in Windows 8 is the Windows video drivers. They change from what's called WDDM, Windows Driver Display Model. It went from 1.1 to 1.2.
Yeah.
And that's mainly because we had to support DirectX 11.1. And NVIDIA and ATI and Intel and all those guys have released those drivers. But if you are still running with a 1.1 driver, that's the Windows 7 or below mm-hmm. driver model, we support that, but we have found that there's been some compatibility issues. Simple answer is update your video drivers and always good. Then when it comes to everything else, the most common issue is pulling bad code forward. So if you do an upgrade rather than a fresh install, so you're not using pure Microsoft drivers, a lot of obvious things like printers and scanners and camera drivers and stuff, well, a lot of those may be showing faults now because the kernel and everything else is more secure or more rigid, and or just maybe the timings have changed. So
And one of the things that I would add to that is one of the things that stood out to me for his question was self-built. Because I've never bought a fully built desktop before. I've always built my own machine.
Actually, this is the only thing I've ever bought from OEM.
But one of the things I would highly suggest is I have a directory called drivers, mm-hmm. and in there, for every machine that I build like that, I take a picture of every component, and I write down the model number for every component before I put it in, so I don't have to rip it apart and try to figure out what it was
good
that I
thinking.
Put in there. And then whenever you need to go look for
I've
drivers,
I've gone in there with a torch to.
Or a flashlight. So you go in there and you're trying to find out, which video card was it and stuff like that. So keep a text file that has here's all the components that I used and maybe even links to the site so that you can get those easily.
So the main two reasons why it's unstable is crashes, right? So it's either an application crash or a whole OS crash.
Yeah.
If it's an application crash, ProcNUP has fully been updated for Windows 8. It supports every nuance there is. 5.0 is out on the website, which has the support. There's a couple of bugs in it. We know about that. But it actually only is bugs in the error path. So if it's doing the right job, then you won't see it.
Yeah.
Use that tool to capture application crashes. And there's defrag shows on that. I think episode 10, 11, 12, somewhere around there. And then when it comes to the kernel crash, you blue screen of death, you will get that memory.dmp file.
Mm-hmm.
I think the episode we're airing in 2 weeks with Chad as the host is the episode where we show you how to analyze those yourself.
Yeah, I broke out my my blue screen t-shirts for that episode.
And the basic statement is install the debugger tools for Windows. It's part of the SDK. You can use the Windows 7 or the Windows 8 SDK for the analysis. So you can use it like an old machine if you want to use it. You don't have to be on a Windows 8.
So like a modern desktop or a modern laptop or something like this machine here, it's easy to test that for Windows 8 because you know that you've got all the same components in there and things don't change. And you can test them all together. But self-built machines, they can be a problem. You never know. One thing might conflict with something else. So that's where you need to know kind of how to troubleshoot things like that. And, of course, use defrag if you can help.
Yeah, Windows is using new features of your hardware that you never used before, too. I mean, the drivers may be updated, and the hardware may have issues and stuff like that. When it comes to OEM PCs, the simple answer is go talk to your OEM. The OEMs are all ramped up for Windows 8. They know this stuff is coming. They know that certain things have been approved for Windows upgrade when it came. So talk to the OEM. When it comes to Microsoft products, answers.microsoft.com is where we route people for questions. If it's a bigger issue than can be answered in the forums, then support.microsoft.com, and then you go into the support framework. And support's been preparing for this.
Horizon, I think.
Yeah.
So we've got a great question here that's a good lead-in from what we're talking about from H. It says, which drivers work with Windows 8? XP, Vista, Windows 7. Let's say you go to a site and they don't have Windows 8 drivers. Mm. What should you look for there?
So it's kind of a limit. So the driver model in Windows was stabilized, is a really good word for it, in Windows Vista, called the Windows Driver Framework and the Windows Driver Model. If drivers were rewritten for that new standard as a Vista, it probably will not show issues in higher versions. I mean, definitely a Windows 7 driver for your printer is probably going to be good. Across the board, it's pretty well the same model. It's just more strict now rather than an issue. So if the bugs have been hidden there for a while, it will come out. Use restore points. I mean, that's what the restore points are for. You get a piece of hardware, install it, and if it doesn't work, roll back to a restore point, and you're good.
Yeah.
Personally, I've seen it being very, very stable, and you know, if there is issues, you know, email the show and email Microsoft, and we'll look into it for you.
Yeah, okay. So a question here from Anonymous says, will there be some defrag tool shows for Windows 8 RT using some special tools like those in sysinternals?
So the thing about Windows RT is it's a locked environment, right, which means we don't allow tools to or programs to be added to it. It's just full stop. The only programs you can install are the store apps. And that includes support tools, right? It's a hard rule, right? There's no way around this lock. So there is no sysinternals tools for ARM. There is no, you can't install all your favorite programs for ARM. Saying that, though, there is the inbuilt tools, Resource Manager, Task Manager, yeah. Event Viewer, they're all still there.
Yeah.
The inbox tools are very good and can get you to root cause. When it comes to things like blue screens and stuff, there's a new feature in Windows 8, which is called network debugging. So what you do is you say, you go into, it's a full command line BCD edit thing, but you go into the command line and say, when I boot, try to establish a kernel debugging session to this IP address over there, provide this massive cryptographic passphrase for security, and then it will talk to that IP address when it boots. And so if there's anything happening in the kernel, your debugger on that other machine will break in. So for people like me who do laptops and stuff a lot, the other thing that they've added is USB 3 support. So it's literally a cable that has the same end, each end, mm-hmm. and there's a new spec to the USB standard that Microsoft forced to go include in the spec, which is actually the ability to debug over USB. So
yeah.
If you need to debug a system, network and USB are the answer. As far as user mode goes, the inbox tools are plenty for a crash, you know, Windows Error Reporting particularly. And when it comes to your own applications, you've got Visual Studio itself, which can do remote debugging. It's one of its standard things that it supports is you develop on your 64-bit machine over here, your big behemoth, and then you remotely deploy it to your WinRT device and test it on it, and it can debug it over the link. So
yeah,
and we support that over Wi-Fi and everything else. So
great.
You're in a pretty good situation out of the box. It's not really we're not back in the dark ages because the tools in the box have moved on.
Okay, and we've got our very special guest with us here. He's coming up to the stage now. So, Mark.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, good
man.
To see you.
You're in the
good
middle.
To see you. Actually,
come on in.
Okay, I think this will work. We got the curve thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little different than Building 20.
A little bit different from our little studio, which used to be a conference room. But thanks for joining us. Where'd you come from?
Good to see you. Good to see you, Andrew.
Yeah.
I came from right upstairs. I was doing a Windows Azure internals talk.
Nice.
This morning.
Awesome. All right. So let's take this next question from Andre. It says, are all USB HID devices that run Windows 7 ready to run Windows RT? And I think the key word there that's going to throw that question is all. So.
Well, the inbox has a lot of HID class driver support for standard HID devices, and we do support the obvious things. I know personally I had picked my Microsoft's Force Feedback joystick back from 1998 and plugged it in, and it worked, right? Because it conforms to a class driver, and so most things that are standardized should be good. I mean, I don't know your knowledge of.
I haven't actually looked at it, so I don't know.
Your machine, I think, just went to sleep.
There's a hardware compatibility page.
Yeah.
That they can go to see.
Yeah, before you upgrade, you can just do a double check.
Yeah.
But as I said, if it's a standard class driver and you haven't been fooling around with the hardware too much, you're pretty well good to go.
Great. Okay, next from Trombone Gnome says, what sysinternal tools are available for ARM?
Nothing.
Yeah, well, actually quite a few internally.
Yeah. Nothing outside.
Yeah, nothing outside.
Okay.
I mean, the problem is the system's locked, and we don't have the certificate on the sysinternals tool to release it. So there's no point releasing it because nobody could run it anyway.
By the way, there's no bugs in ARM, right?
So. Nah.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
Perfect. Yeah.
All right. And next question. Defrag tools will show all sysinternal tools. After those, what tools will you be using for the show? So are we going to retire after that?
There's other tools?
Yeah, so we've only done 12 out of the 70 so far.
So we're good for a little while longer.
I meant other tools besides the sysinternals tools.
Well, there is some.
Not good ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. the ones you have to fall back to.
Yeah.
We've done 12.
When the customer doesn't let you load them for some bizarre, archaic reason.
Yeah. The system installs are too good. Yeah. You want to use this bad, dodgy one instead.
Let's test. Let's see how good you are.
Yeah. So we've done 12 episodes, I believe, on SysInternals. We went through the big boys, Explorer, Monitor, VMAP, RAMMAP, AutoRuns. We haven't done PS Exec yet.
That's a big one.
That's a big one we need to do. We're currently going through a 10 to 15 episode WinDBG thing to teach you how to do debugging.
Mainly many episode?
15.
Holy crap.
Well, we're shrinking down 120 hours
that'll
of content.
Keep you busy.
Yeah, with 120 hours of content, which is a course we've got internally, that we're condensing down to a 15-week run at half an hour each.
All right, so it'll be a while before you get back to SysKernels tools.
Well, then we're doing Windows Performance Analyzer. Oh, okay. So that's probably about 5 or 10 weeks, and then we'll get back to SysKernels.
Okay.
So we'll see you in summer next year.
Yeah.
And then we're depending on you to write new tools to keep us in business so we can keep doing the show. So,
okay.
No pressure.
Yeah, I'm still writing new tools. I wrote PSPing. Right?
Yeah. That's new.
Is that the latest?
That's the latest tool. Latest new tool, yeah. It's network. Actually, I demoed it in the session that I just gave.
Tell us a little bit about it.
So it's, did we talk about it on the last defrag? I can't remember if we
I think we mentioned it in passing and when you were guest
yeah,
visited. Yeah,
that it was going to come out. But it's out now. And so I wrote it because networking is really the air that the cloud breathes.
Yeah.
And so it's extremely important to understand network performance in cloud applications, also our infrastructure. And the tools that I found that we use, well, first of all, what we give our customers for measuring network performance basically is ping. Mm. And ping doesn't even do sub-millisecond resolution. So that matters to us.
Yeah.
And there's no really good tools that I could find internally or externally that will do latency tests between point-to-point, bandwidth tests point-to-point, or just pinging a TCP port to see how long it takes to connect to it.
Yeah.
And so that's where PSPing came from. It does ICMP pings with sub-millisecond resolution. It does TCP connection pings. It does latency tests and bandwidth tests. Mm-hmm. And I made it as easy to use as I could, because one of the problems I ran into with the tools that I was using is you've got the client and the server that you want to test the performance between, network performance between, and you've got to run this command line over on the server, then run this kind of very similar command line over on the client, and then they run their test, and then they both exit. Mm. And in some cases, they'll spit out averages, but they won't give you a histogram or other information that will show you the variability over time. And so I said, I want a tool that I can just run the server side once, and then I can have the client side execute it multiple times and also generate histograms of the results so that we can dump stuff into Excel spreadsheets and look
at
variability over time. So that's what you can do, is you can do a latency test, then you can do a bandwidth test, and you can have it do histograms with the number of buckets you specify and all of that.
Have you tried any international type links? I mean, being from Australia, I know how slow the internet is from Australia, just purely from the speed of electron distance. And have you tried any long distance stuff?
I've tried stuff in Azure going from data centers in the US to data centers in Europe. And it's latencies you kind of expect. The speed of light is a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does actually factor in.
Yeah.
All right. I got a question here. Mark, will you write a book, Windows Phone Internals, How to Learn More About Using Infrastructure Components Troubleshooting?
No. I don't know of any way to put that less bluntly.
There is Windows Phone Internals.
There's a Windows Phone Internals?
Yeah.
Is it really internals?
It's called Windows Phone 7 Internals and Windows Phone 8 Internals.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
All right.
There
you go. It's out.
And actually, I get asked, are you going to do a Windows Internals book that covers Windows 8? And the answer is, unfortunately, I can't. I mean, I just don't have the bandwidth to do it. I think everybody sees how long it took for the 7th edition or 6th edition to come out.
You beat Windows 8 by a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we did. That was our goal, beat Windows 8.
So we talk about the differences on defrag tools. So if we cover them, then, I mean, you could always watch us, and we'll go over a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm updating the tools, though.
The system sounds tools. When you were off air, we went through some of the major changes you've done for Windows 8.
All right, next question from Vivek Pai says, ever thought about using telemetry data to generate and deliver temporary patches to common driver issues? A lot of customers experience bug checks due to specific buffer overflow.
Well,
that's actually what Windows Update It does.
Does, yeah. So the telemetry comes into a team called OCA, which is Online Crash Analysis. They track what's called buckets, which is a signature, I suppose is the word for it.
Thumbprint.
And they, whatever the top issues are, they make sure that, you know, if it's Microsoft, they get them out on Windows Update. And if it's a third party, we forward them onto the third party and say, hey, you've got a buggy driver.
Yeah,
And Vivek is a Niner, so shout out to you, too. So that's what gets sent when it says, you know, do you want to send an error report? You should send those. I mean, it's there's no private information in there, and it's used to help make things better. So it's something that really helps if you contribute that, because the more issues that we see like that, the better we can help fix those.
That's fine.
Another one from Zippy V says, Windows supports hot patching for all system files. Why do we still need to reboot after installing Windows updates? Good question.
All yours.
Actually, Windows hot patching was something that seemed like a good idea at the time, but then once you look at the fixes that get rolled into those monthly updates, there's almost always a component that requires a fix that can't be addressed with hot patching.
Yeah.
So all you need is one of those, and then your efforts to hot patch go out the window because you still need to reboot. So Windows team can speak to this directly, but when I was there, we de-invested in supporting hot patching just because of that particular problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question for Mark. PS Ping is the latest and greatest, but can you tell us about some new stuff you're working on now? Let's drop some news here. Let's talk about new things.
What happened to Azure Storage Explorer?
I got distracted. Actually, there's great freeware ones that are completely free that are actually decent, so I ended up using those. And so as far as new tools, do I have any new tools? I basically have a long list of enhancements to existing tools. If you look over the last year or so, there's been, just maintaining the existing tools and adding the features that people want or I think are cool to them is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like, I just released desktops for Windows 8. You might have talked about that.
I missed that one.
Okay. So I just, I released an update to desktops. Windows 8. And that desktops does virtual desktops, up four virtual desktops. And I had to update it to Windows 8 to deal with the Windows key and start screen. So the Windows key behavior changed a little bit. So the way that desktops intercepts Windows key on alternate desktops and then does the right accelerators had to be updated, as well as the fact that...
And what's method now to switch between desktops?
So it's the same as before, the hotkeys. Mm-hmm. But if you press Windows key by itself, it takes you to the start screen. So which is only available on virtual desktop 1, just because it's not it doesn't support running on concurrently on multiple desktops. Mm-hmm. So when you press Windows key, Windows 8,
it's
getting to the start screen. And prior to this release, if you were on desktop 2 and press Windows key, nothing would happen.
Yeah.
So you'd have to switch back to desktop 1 and then press Windows key.
So it's kind of like a multi-monitor feel, where the other monitors don't have the start screen either. You just get the taskbars, right?
Yeah.
And what about touch?
Touch just works.
Could you have like a tile for each desktop then? I don't want you to have to code anymore.
Let's see. Right now it's a desktop app, and it has to be to access the APIs for switching desktops. If it was, I don't know if there's really any advantage to making a Metro app, and it would have to communicate with the desktop app somehow to have it
and
do the switching.
Do you typically work on one tool at a time?
Sorry, I didn't mean that. I meant Windows 8 app. I mean Windows App Store app.
Yeah, I think there's someone standing over there who wants to talk to you afterwards.
Windows App Store app.
Take him out. Do you typically work on one tool at a time, or you have like a couple projects going?
I have a couple projects. Process Explorer right now, in the middle of updating that to Aaron Margosis, a good friend of me and Andrew's, asked that I make the token list sortable and that I improve the copy-paste out of the properties dialog box. So got that fix coming out.
And is the fix out for the handle stuff where you were just saying the word handle instead of actually giving you the name of the handle? And that's out by now.
What bug was that?
It was in the search. when you search, it used to say only handle and didn't tell you whether.
Yeah, now it tells you the type of handle.
That was a great fix, that one.
Yeah.
All right, so we got another question from Wally, but just so you know, we've got about, 15 minutes or so. If you want to ask a question, just go ahead and scroll down, put your question in, and we'll get it here to Mark or to Andrew. And next one's from Wally. He says, how about power consumption tools, native versus managed WinRT apps?
So is it for the whole box or per application? I'm not sure what they're asking, but Windows has power consumption built into ETW, which we briefly mentioned before. Just run Windows Performance Analyzer. The UI says one of them is power consumption, and just turn on that graph and do your test and go start and stop and bring up the graph, and it will show you the frequency of the CPU. It will show you all the metrics to do with power consumption during that period. So if you want to
help. So is that the best method? If you've written an application, you want to make sure that you've optimized it so it's not going to dump the battery. What are the steps you should go through? What are the tools you should use? And what can you do to help with that?
I think Windows Performance Analyzer is the best tool out there, without a doubt. It is a learning curve, though.
Yeah.
And that's why it's actually one of the reasons why it hasn't been on Defrag yet is Chad and I have to be really sure that we know it 100% correct before we go and expel it to the world. And so, it's a new tool. They revitalized it in Windows 8, and so it's a bit of a learning curve for us as well as everybody else. But, it can tell you everything. There's just nothing it can't tell you.
I mean, if you think the sysinternals tools like Process Explorer, understanding the second level and deeper of information there requires a degree in Windows internals, this thing requires... You know,
PhD.
PhD. It's not just a bachelor degree tool.
Yeah. Great tool, though.
Yeah.
All right. And if you want to send your questions in, we got an open board here, so you can send your question out, and we'll ask it. So let's talk a little bit about VHD. That was one of the subjects that we wanted to cover today.
Yeah, we know that you had a hand in it. So what I was going to show is it keeps on getting mentioned on Scott Hanselman, on the Defrag show, about Scott Hanselman's blog post on how to boot from VHD. Mm-hmm. And my machine, if you just follow this down, roughly what you do is you start installing Windows, and then when you get to the partition screen, you press Shift F10, bring up the console, go to disk part, and then make a disk then, or attach to a disk that already exists, and then boot from VHD. How does that work? I mean, how does a file on a disk turn into a disk? I mean, I think it's the question that everybody really doesn't get.
Well, so if you get Windows internals, I think the storage chapters in part one talks about boot from VHD, but there's a virtual VHD SCSI mini port driver that just mounts the VHD off of the file system. So it presents a virtual disk to the system. The system doesn't know what's behind it. It just happens to be that it's a file on a disk that's already mounted. So there's a dependency chain. And that was actually the most challenging part of implementing the architecture for boot from VHD, was knowing the dependencies as you tore things down, because you could have multiple volumes that are on top of a VHD file that are on top of then a physical logical volume on top of another physical disk. And so the shutdown process has to be tear it down from the top, because if you pull it from the bottom, then you've got modified writes that can't get back to their storage device. So that was part of that nesting that occurs.
I don't know about you, but I now exclusively use VHDs. I don't actually use my physical drive anymore.
Yeah. Well, in Windows, so the VHD mentality came from Windows Azure before I joined the team, but they decided that image-based deployment was the most reliable way to make sure that the bits that you've specified get to where they're supposed to go.
Yeah.
And so that's where that first was implemented. It was kind of a hack, because they were parting on Windows just to get things working for the Windows Azure environment. This is kind of the technology transfer between Windows Server and Windows Azure. Mm. It goes in both ways, but then there was Windows team was busy, very busy, because we hadn't done joint planning between Windows Azure and Windows team. Mm-hmm. And so the Azure team was forced to go and work on the stuff independently and take shortcuts. And then the Windows team would come back and say, okay, this is Windows, and it's going to be in a very diverse environment with people that will run into problems, and we need to make sure that it's architected cleanly to handle all of the weird cases that you won't run into in Azure, but we will. Yeah. So now we're actually in a joint planning arrangement with Windows. So we work together. So as Windows works on deciding what they're going to do, we're sitting there with them and saying, Windows Azure would like this, and let's work on the requirements together. And
so we've got a question on the subject. It says, Mark, you showed it partially, but what actually happens when you drag a VHD into a VHD as well?
Actually,
it's inception happens.
Yeah, it's inception, yeah. That was one of my favorite demos.
Let's do it. I actually have it right here. I have a physical hard drive, like a platter, and I have an SSD. And then on my SSD, I have a folder called VHD. And this is the two VHDs I have on here. The top one is the Defrag Show VHD, and this one's the one I'm booted into. So can I copy it? Just straight copy, right?
Yeah.
And so this is my current... I'm actually live on this disk right now. This is actually my OS right now, and I'm copying it to
it's
physical.
It's at the very top level, Explorer is just looking at the VHD file and seeing when it reads a sector or a block from that file, what happens to be in the physical disk, the virtual physical disk, basically what Windows has already written back to it. So it's not really representing the state of the volume because it doesn't reflect stuff that's cached but hasn't been written back to it. And it's not a consistent view of the VHD either, because let's say that there's a block 3 sitting in the cache, or there's an app that's going to modify block 3, and the Explorer copies block 1, 2, copies block 1 and 2, copies block 3, block 3 is written after that, block 4 was written before that, and it's a write that goes with block 3, so it copies the modified block 4 and continues on. So it's got a block 3 from before that those operations and block 4 from after the operations, and that's potentially
a torn.
Looks like corruption from the perspective of NTFS or an application. So it's not a consistent copy. It's just kind of a cool blow-your-mind demo. But
so the trick is, if you want to back up who you are, like if I want to back up this image, boot into another VHD, and then copy it off.
Yeah, then
cleanly.
You can do that, and then you can just do the copy.
Like
but
plain,
also virtual, you know, you can do snapshots, too, to get clean copies.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a question here. It says, for Mark again, tell us about the new great kernel stuff on Windows 8 and Server 2012.
Actually, so that's an area that I'm not an expert in at this point because I've been focusing on Windows Azure. So.
Okay. All right. Next question. Have you come across any diagnostic surprises with Windows 8 thus far?
Launchy modern apps.
Diagnostic surprises, yeah. Andrew's shared with me some of his surprises.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It took a fair while to get ProcDump upgraded so it could launch a Microsoft Store app. The thing is, it's not an app anymore. It's not an XE anymore. You're negotiating with Process Lifetime Management, another subsystem in Windows, to start the program. And the old way of thinking, the old way of interacting with programs just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And so that took a little bit of a hurdle, a little bit of a learning hurdle.
So one of the things that people think about with sysinternal tools is fixing the problems on your machine, fixing the apps that you write yourself, but talk a little bit about using the tools for detecting and solving viruses and security issues.
Well, actually, that's one of my favorite ways to use the tools these days. I just published a Case of the Unexplained blog post. I don't know did you see it?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Case of the Unexplained FTP Connections.
Yeah, that was cool.
And that one came from Microsoft, from PSS.
Yeah, from Security Division, yeah.
Yeah, the Security Division there, where customers call Microsoft and say, we think we've been breached, we've been attacked, we believe we've got malware. And, you know, they've paid for support services, and so Microsoft will go in and help them clean it up and do forensic analysis. In this particular case, they use Process Monitor to figure out what is this FTP connectivity coming from. First thing you want to do when you believe that you've been attacked is to go and do some reconnaissance to figure out, A, is it really an attack? Then, B, what's it look like it's doing? Let's just get some idea. So the case walks through the use of Process Monitor and network tracing in Process Monitor to figure out that in the end that it was a SQL server with no admin password sitting on the perimeter with an open firewall port that let attackers infect the SQL server and then execute code on the box.
They had the launch command feature
turned on in SQL Server. Which used to be a great way for viruses to propagate before that was removed by default.
Yeah.
So they basically just opened the door completely to the server without really thinking about it. I'm sure it was just some admin that wanted ability to do some troubleshooting or run?
Well, the way I read the post, I mean, I don't know really what the details are behind it. I got the feeling that they thought it was behind some massive layer of firewalls when actually it was actually on the Internet Raw.
Yeah, I think that's what they thought. But even if it's behind all those firewalls, you still don't open up your SQL Server that way.
Yeah.
Because it opens up the box completely to unauthenticated access.
Yeah.
So it's just not a good way to operate. And we can only piece it together because the admins, I guess, that were working with the security team, either they were the ones that did it and didn't want to admit it, or they didn't know who did it.
Yeah.
So in either case, we don't know really what happened. But the case is really kind of cool because it shows process monitor. By far, the most cases I've collected are process monitor. It's probably like 80% of the cases I've got are process monitor.
I'd say 80% of cases in support process monitor as well. It's just the tool.
Yeah, and then for just analyzing malware, I've done posts on analyzing Stuxnet and analyzing Scareware with process monitor, and I got in my demos from my Case Unexplained talks at TechEd US and Europe this summer, or I think it was Europe, analyzing Flame.
Yeah.
So just watching the infection of Flame and Stuxnet, and you can actually see the files get dropped, you can see them get reactivated, you can see where the auto start locations are placed. So it's really a great tool for getting a map of the way that malware operates.
Yeah.
Another question here. Can Mark talk about Linux and MySQL support on Azure? Some web applications don't use MSQL.
Yeah, well, so Linux is supported on Windows Azure, four different distros that we've got up there, and MySQL. You want to install MySQL, you install MySQL, and you're off and running. So we do have a platform image in our gallery that has Windows Server plus SQL Server Trial Edition installed in it so that you can get that up and going quickly. But you can bring your own Linux images with your own MySQL installed into it or install on top of our platform images, and either one will work.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
All right, so we're coming down to the last couple minutes here. One thing that I want to ask you about is if you're a developer and you're focused on, you know, learning about how to be a better programmer, how much do you need to know about security, and how do you get ramped up to know as much as you need to know about security?
That's a great question because that answer's changed a lot over the last 10 years. Mm. It used to be you wrote a program, you gave it to a customer, they ran it on their box, and they were responsible for securing the box and the network connections and who used the application and how they used it. But today, everybody's writing apps that have pieces in the cloud and pieces on client devices.
Yeah.
And so now you've got a surface area that's exposed to the outside world, either your cloud endpoints or your mobile apps. Typically, you're multi-tenant, which means that you've got lots of customers that are sharing the back end, your back end infrastructure. Mm. So now you really need to be cognizant of not mixing data between customers, of having denial of service prevention in your front ends and your infrastructure, making sure that the network authentication is reliable and you're not just taking simple magic keys and passing them around.
Don't do simple things like store the password in clear text.
Yeah.
Hash
and
thing.
Have SSL connections between your front ends and your clients. I mean, it's all sorts of stuff that you now have to worry about if you want to be...
And probably the most important thing that you can do is get Mark's books.
Yeah.
So
that goes without saying.
Talk about your latest
book. Just about any problem.
We'll close on your latest book. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah.
And you can get it anywhere, of course.
That's right. So the latest book is Trojan Horse. It's actually a fiction book, and it is a sequel to Zero Day, which I came out with last year. The Trojan Horse, speaking of malware and attacks and breaches, is the same vein. It's a techno thriller, and it's focused on state-sponsored cyber espionage, countries using malware to attack each other and to do cyber espionage against each other, the same way that Stuxnet.
How old is that? How long has that been going on?
That's longer than we know, and actually there was a great story, a great book, too, that I've got to give high recommendations for anybody that likes books like this. My book is fiction based on what's going on in the real world.
Scary fiction.
With current technology, of course, and the current trends in malware. But there's a book by a guy named Clifford Stoll, wrote it in 1989. It's called The Cuckoo's Egg. And it reads like a techno thriller, except it's a true story. He was a network admin at University of California, Berkeley, and he noticed his boss said, hey, there's an accounting issue here with... Back then, they were accounting, tracking CPU usage on their servers and charging for them on their mainframes. There's a usage here that we can't account for, a few cents here. So he starts to dig into it and pull on this thread, and it ends up being this international government-sponsored cyber espionage
wow.
program that eventually led to the arrest of a guy in Germany after several years. But the story of the way he goes from, hey, there's an accounting issue, to tracking this down to servers around the world and figuring out that it's been infected a bunch of government servers in the U.S., it's an awesome story.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us here today. And that's the end of the show. And coming up next is going to be Scott Hanselman. So stay tuned.